Well, regular listeners to our World News Wrap here on Breakfast After Six every morning will be very familiar with the voice and the work of Lise Doucette. Her title, a fantastic title, Chief International Correspondent for BBC World News. Canadian-born, Lise regularly anchors special news coverage from the field. She's covered major conflicts, natural disasters, and interviewed world leaders for programs right across the BBC networks. Lise Doucette spent 15 years as a BBC foreign correspondent with some of the hardest postings, Jerusalem, Tehran, Islamabad, Kabul, before joining the BBC's team of presenters in 1999. Most recently, she played a key role in the BBC's coverage of the Arab Spring across the Middle East and North Africa, including the Syrian conflict, where she was the first Western journalist to enter Qusair after it was retaken by the Syrian government in June.
This is what victory sounds like in Qusair. The soldiers are stopping us in their cars as they move around and the guns are being fired in celebration. Now there's soldiers in front of us. They've got red ribbons attached to their shoulders and they're speaking with Lebanese accents.
Minwen, Lebanon? Liban? Lebanon?
I asked them where they're from. Lebanon. And they're shouting slogans in support of Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. Syrian flags are everywhere, so are the Syrian troops. You can see all around us evidence of the fierce weeks of battle that were waged here. The windows shattered, the doors blown out, the balconies pockmarked with gunfire. This was a bloody battle for a strategic city. Qusair is gone, but the fighting will certainly go on.
Lise Doucette, in the middle of a war zone there, a situation she's been in many times in her career. I'm happy to say now that she's in Australia speaking for a number of speaking engagements and she joins us in the breakfast studio. A much safer place to be, Lise Doucette. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Pat. It's really nice to be here with you. And I have to say that every time I come to Sydney, I'm just so taken by what a beautiful, beautiful city this is. And it's a bit jarring to be brought back to Qusair, a city which died, a city which was completely devastated as we sit around a beautiful warm winter's day here in Sydney.
Yeah, when you hear a report like that, does it? I guess it takes you back to where you were, and the contrast to where you are now must be phenomenal. But in that situation, when you're in the middle of it there, what are your emotions? What happens to someone when you're in a war zone like that?
Well, it takes your breath away in every way, Fran, because you... In the first place, when we went to Qusair, it was in the immediate hours after battle, so you could hear the gunfire, and that was wasn't gunfire against an opposing side. The battle had ended, but that was gunfire fired in celebration. But and when you look at the city of Qusair with maybe not a journalist eyes, but human eyes, you say, what is there to celebrate? You remember that phrase used by an American soldier in the Vietnam War, which was, to save a city, we had to destroy it. And Qusair was absolutely, completely flattened. And my first question was, where are all the people? Where did the people go? Did they die? Did they flee? And when, how will they ever rebuild Qusair again? So every time I hear, and I've covered, I've been covering Syria during these last 2.5 years of its own uprising, is that every time there's a major battle, another part of Syria dies. So even when, if you want to use the expression, you win, one side wins, many other people lose, millions lose.
And how hard is it, or how easy is it to forget that, the human side of it, to look with human eyes when you're in a place like that? I mean, very often in your career, you've reported from war zones, reporting on a war for an audience back home or externally. The news can be very two-dimensional at times like that because you've got a job. And does that shut off your human eyes?
It's very interesting, and I've thought a lot about how we cover wars, because wars of another day in our parents and our grandparents' generation were wars far away, and there were front lines. Wars like we're seeing now in Syria are wars on a society where whole cities, as we've just been saying, are completely devastated. Life is gone. Life is shattered. And whole, bit by bit, all of Syria is being broken. And you can't cover a war like that, although sometimes it is done, that there's the opposition and that there's the government. there's the people as well, because in addition to being in so many different kinds of war, what's happening in Syria is a civil war, a sectarian war, it's a regional proxy war, it's a new Cold War, but I always say too, it's a war on childhood, because lives are being destroyed even as they begin.
And the soldiers, it's sometimes hard to remember the soldiers on both sides.
Exactly.
are people too. You've spent so many years reporting in this region and you've been to Syria a number of times. Are you, after all this time, are you familiar to these soldiers, to these fighters? Do they recognize you? Do they approach you to tell their stories?
Even people who carry a gun, and sometimes the most powerful of guns, are fathers, brothers, sometimes grandfathers. They're human beings. They have a story. And sometimes soldiers are just conscripts. They have been told to go and fight. We've seen that in Syria. We've seen that in Afghanistan, where they have to open fire on their own people and sometimes their own cousins. And again, it's back to that point. In order, I think, to cover these stories as we should and to make our audiences care, we have to cover them in a human way, because that's what they are at the end. They're also human stories. And sadly, they are sad stories. But the thing which has also struck me in all my years of reporting is that sometimes, and in fact, very often, in situations of the greatest inhumanity, you find a very profound humanity as well.
Can you give us a sense of that? Is there something that has struck you in your career that stays with you to demonstrate that?
Well, I remember just the first, what would come to my mind is I remember the 90s when you had a situation in Afghanistan after the very historic war when the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan. It was of course, the height of the Cold War. There was a Western-backed Mujahideen war against them. And then the Soviet army left, the Red Army left. And then when the Mujahideen came to Kabul, Kabul was torn apart. And I used to go night after night and sit with some of the soldiers, including the Afghan army chief of staff. And one night he just broke down crying, and he talked about his son in the United States, and his son was ill. He didn't know when he would see his son again. He talked about all the war, about all the years he'd been on the front line as a Mujahideen, and now he was in Kabul, and he wasn't sure that they were actually doing right by their people, because the city of Kabul at that point was being torn apart. And I'll never forget that, and it's not the first time it's happened, where away from the cameras, away from the sort of the blinding light of the day, people share their thoughts with you. And you see, you go inside these dark, deep corners and you see a different side of the story that we hear in the headlines.
It's 16 to 8 on Breakfast. Our guest this morning is Lise Doucette. She's Chief International Correspondent for BBC World News. And as she was just reminding us there, she's been covering conflicts in places like Kabul for a long time now, since the late 80s, early 90s. You've been back to Kabul many times over that period. You must have quite an intense relationship with that city, and it must have changed enormously over the time, from the late 80s, as you were there for the withdrawal of the Soviet troops, to the position we find Kabul in now. And I think you've said that Afghanistan is getting more and more dangerous.
It's interesting. Last night I was watching, actually, on the ABC, a memorial, an exhibition that's just started here in Australia to pay tribute to the many Australians who died in battle in Afghanistan. And, of course, you would know, and you may have had them on your program here, those who have come back who are injured or scarred. And Australia is like my country, Canada. We have had learned the hard lessons of being a country that has to go to war to send soldiers, men and women, far away to fight. And why do we go and fight? Well, also for the protection of our own countries, but also because Afghanistan, the country, of course, in 2000, after the attacks of 9/11, we said we would all be standing shoulder to shoulder for the long run. And for me, it's been a test case of what is the long run? What do we mean in Westerns or in more advanced societies when we're going to stay with a country that's been racked by three decades of war for the long run? It turns out it may only mean a decade, because governments come and go, people get tired, they want to move on to the next thing. And I'm sure you're going to be covering a lot in your programs that most of the NATO forces are going to leave this year and the next year. And what will be left? Well, there will be a country which has been profoundly changed by this huge international intervention in Afghanistan. But did it change to the level and to the standard we may have expected after the trillions of dollars that have been invested there and the lives have been lost, both Afghan and foreigners. I think there's great disappointment all around. Afghans are grateful, but it hasn't turned out not the way they expected and not the way we expected either. And I think it's a sobering lesson for international intervention in our time.
Yes, and we don't really hear much of what the people in Afghanistan feel about it. We know there was a degree of optimism initially and hope. But as you say, as you've just described, trillions of dollars, many, many lives lost, complete city and destruction and tension within that society. What are Afghan people feeling at this point, and particularly the women who I think perhaps had a lot invested in the West coming in to help?
History means a lot in Afghanistan. It's one of those societies where people live the history as it's in the present. And we have these, people have these sayings where they say, oh, Afghanistan is a country of tough warriors, a mountain people. They've always expelled invaders across the centuries. And my feeling about Afghanistan is, no, they haven't expelled the invaders across the century. What they have expelled and what they have taken arms up against is people who come in with ideas and ambitions for their country, which are in contradiction with what Afghans want for themselves. They welcome ideas as long as they feel they are consistent with their own cultures, their own dreams, their own aspirations for them, for their families, and for their future. And I think if we look back since over the last more about a decade and a half since the international community intervened in or became part or engaged in Afghanistan again, some of things have worked. More schools have been built. Healthcare has been better. Technology is better. It's a nation now where almost everyone has a mobile telephone. More kids are going to school. But how can it be that the security situation is in many ways worse than it was when just before the Taliban were toppled after the...
And girls are still getting targeted for going to school.
Girls are getting targeted, and fathers and mothers are saying it's too dangerous for my daughter to walk to school and there are not enough women teachers. And I think we were too ambitious. We shouldn't have expected that a country shattered by 30 years of war can suddenly in a decade become a different country.
And at least we could talk for hours. We could talk for hours, but time is upon us. But in terms of how this impacts you personally, when people look at, you know, had moments of hope, you were there covering the Arab Spring. I know you were in Tahrir Square when Mubarak was deposed, and I think you've cited that moment as one of the highlights of your career, just experiencing the intensity of that feeling. What do you think? What do you make of events of the last month or so in Egypt, and where that's come to? So quickly.
I think as foreigners...
And do you feel that personally?
Well, I think you have to feel it personally, because what's the point of doing this? You can't just go in as an automaton and say, I'm here to ask who, when, what, where, why. We, of course, are affected as humans. It can't allow us to affect our coverage in a way that we become biased or become too emotional. But I think our listeners, our viewers want a little bit of ourselves invested in. We have to, again, as I say, you have to take a human approach to the reporting. And sometimes there are moments which are just sheer euphoria. You know, I will never forget how blissful it felt to be in Tahrir Square when you felt a whole nation had risen up and said, we are making our own history at last, and we are doing it peacefully. We are changing our future. Now Egypt is a very different place, but when people make their own history, it's a very unpredictable unfolding, and they have to make it themselves, and we are only there to help them where we can, to report their stories, to be their storytellers, but they are the main actors in this story. We have a very minor part in the whole plot.
Lise Doucette, it's incredible to hear your stories, and interesting and a privilege to hear your take on how we should be reporting on these important stories. Thanks so much for joining us. Enjoy these few quiet days in Sydney.
Thank you, Fran.
Lise Doucette is Chief International Correspondent for BBC World News. And in Australia, Lise will be speaking at Storyology, the 2013 Walkley Media Conference on Thursday, and at the Lowy Institute for International Policy, War, Peace and Middle East Politics on Friday. And she's well poised to know a lot about all of that. It's 10 minutes to 9 on Breakfast.